and I've had to sit in for everybody this week. But this represents the work of our group, so I think I hope to do it justice. I'd like to talk today a bit about an aspect of the BRACE framework, which is the step that intends to look forward and project a disease burden in order to allow health departments to prioritize and look into what their future health threats would be. And all of this evidence-based approach builds upon the findings of climate change science in a number of aspects, from the IPCC report and the National Climate Assessment Report, which are both issued last year. And these, I would say, landmark reports really not only solidify the science, but provide extra impetus to act sooner than later. And what both of these reports found is that we're seeing changes in not only the mean global temperature, but also the variance, the frequency of extremely rare weather events, but also that these impacts don't play out evenly across the globe. They're highly dependent upon regional observations. To illustrate this, this series of graphs highlights some observed changes in summertime temperatures across the United States. And this is a typical distribution of summertime temperatures, 1951 to 1980. And as I animate this, you'll see two things happen. First, 81, 91, 91 to 2001, you would, as expect, see the curve shift to the right. That's mean temperature increasing. But the other thing that you notice in this animation is this curve flattens. Tails of the distribution get a little bit fatter, and the normal days become less normal. This indicates two things, that we're seeing a change in the mean as well as a change in the variance. And both of these aspects have important implications for public health. Not only will we see changes in longer growing seasons, warmer summer temperatures, but unusual events will become more important. In addition, we have to calibrate our observations about climate impacts on whatever sector, including health, to the region in which they're being observed. One thing we always say every day when we show up to work at the Climate Health Program is that the impacts of climate change are place-specific and path-dependent. We have to remember that as we work with health departments from Florida to Maine to Oregon, that we have to really understand what the local impacts are. And so this chart from the New York Times really shows that some parts of the country are experiencing much greater than that 1.5 degree Fahrenheit increase, Minnesota, for example. And also, if you happen to find yourself in Alabama, there is no global warming, and you'd be safe to say that. There's important regional impacts on climate change and trends. Afforestation of the South has had a great impact on temperature trends over the last century, and we have to understand what those interactions mean as well. So what does this all mean for health? Well, first of all, the impacts of climate change on health are already underway. This isn't something hypothetical into the future. We're seeing and observing these. And certainly climate change will amplify existing health threats, especially in those most vulnerable. But fortunately for us, public health actions, especially preparedness and prevention, can do much to protect people from many of these exposures. And that's where we come in. But not only will climate change impact via extreme events, there are a number of pathways through which climate change will affect health. Certainly, it will add to the cumulative stresses, as we mentioned with ozone and some temperature extremes, degraded air quality from pollen, from wildfire smoke, will add to the cumulative stresses currently being faced by vulnerable populations, especially in those locations most vulnerable to these exposures. So I call this morbidity mortality by 1,000 cuts, this general increasing in these exposures, sometimes subtle, but certainly very important. And this is exemplified. This is a study by Kim Knowlton, who's sitting over there, showing that just looking at 2020, the projected increases in pediatric ED visits will be substantial. This is only a few years from now as a result of temperature changes interacting with ozone. And this adds to the cumulative burden on these pediatric populations. The other pathway through which climate change will affect health is through the amplifying extreme events. The sheer magnitude, one of those images got flipped. Maybe that's on purpose. I guess it's symbolic. But by the not only the increasing frequency, but the increasing magnitude of these events, as we've seen in many superstorms, including the one last week in the Pacific Ocean, will increase the probability that important systems will fail during these events. That in the magnitude of these events increases the probability of these disasters within a disaster. And if we look at not so recent, but a study of a power outage in New York City that was analyzed by Anderson and Bell, that just a power outage of a day or two caused an increase in accidental deaths of 120%, non-accidental deaths of 25%. The loss of these critical infrastructure, energy, communication, transportation, all interact with health in very significant ways. And the magnitude of these events can have some very direct and immediate effects on health. But not only immediate and direct effects on health, but also long-lasting effects. This is a map showing the zip code of those that left New Orleans following Katrina. And the persistent impact on these communities and these individuals continues to this day. We did a study with the city of Austin, Texas, a hazard vulnerability assessment, and we said, what are those climate-related hazards that are most significant for the health of your community? And we went through this process, and they came back with hurricanes. And I was like, but have you ever had a hurricane in Austin, Texas? They said, no. But every time there's a hurricane on the Gulf Coast, we receive 10,000, 15,000 people in great need of our services. That does have an impact on people's health. And these transboundary, long-range impacts are significant and should be considered when these storms are being assessed for their impact. The third key health threat from climate change is that we should expect the unexpected, that these large-scale ecological perturbations will bring surprises with this. We have an example of Lyme disease in the United States that we're noticing, observing changes in the distribution of Lyme disease as a result of increased growing degree days, milder winters, increased tick density, and a number of other large-scale ecological changes that are occurring. This is the Lyme disease case distribution in 1996, and this is it in 2011. And this is increasingly a concern for those in the northern parts of New England who are seeing these ticks extend further and further north. Our grantees in New Hampshire and Vermont are employing really innovative strategies to identify the spread of these ticks using crowdsourcing. We have a tick tracker application where a person can take a picture of a tick and have it identified via the internet, and we have a GPS location of that as well. But this is different. This is case of Lyme disease data, but showing that we should be thinking ahead to where these threats might emerge and develop clinician capacity, laboratory capacity, identify these threats as they move into different locations. So, to summarize, the impacts of climate change from temperatures, extreme weather, sea level, and increasing CO2 levels have an impact on a wide variety of exposures, from increased extreme heat, air pollution, ecological changes from vector ecology to allergens and water quality impact will in turn affect a wide variety of health outcomes. Very few of these, none of these, are new health threats that haven't been identified. But where they are found and the intensity in which they are found will be the principal health challenge for public health departments. So this is where we step in. CDC, the National Center for Environmental Health and the Climate Health Program, has as its primary initiative the Climate Ready States and Cities Initiative, which is our effort to enhance the ability of state and local health departments to understand climate impacts in their region, assess the key threats that climate change poses for them, and to put in place measures to anticipate and respond to these threats. Our role in this is to provide funding, but also to provide a framework for adaptation planning that is evidence-based, that is defensible, and provides direction into which strategies might be best and most appropriate to engage in when protecting their population from these threats. Our job is to provide this framework, we call it BRACE, but also guidance on each step of BRACE. Our current grantee cohort consists of 18 grantees, two cities, New York and San Francisco, and 16 state health departments, including Illinois, where we are now. And we work with these health departments to not only work with them, but they work collaboratively together to develop this best practices process for assessing climate change health impacts. And we mentioned we call this the Building Resilience Against Climate Effects Framework, which is a five-step process and many sub-steps within each of these steps that starts with an assessment of climate change impacts in a region. The grantees partner with local climatologists, local universities, state climatologists to assess what their current experience with a range of meteorologic exposures are. So they look retrospectively, so what is our historic experience with days over 100, or coastal inundation, et cetera. And then they look forward into the future and say, how might this change? What are the most significant changes that we're going to experience? In addition to that, it's important to link these climate changes with the attributes of their population and their geography that are most significant in the assessment of vulnerability. Attributes of population like demographics, what is the proportion of elderly, those with comorbidities, what are the locations in cities that might confer specific risk, like urban heat islands, floodplains, coastal zones, and to identify those populations and locations most vulnerable. The second step, which I'd like to focus on more closely, is the projecting disease burden, which looks into the future and in the best manner possible, tries to get an estimate, either qualitative or quantitative, of where things are going and which health effects might be most important in the future. Then this assessment of disease burden for particular health effects is matched with a variety of options, best practices, and evidence-based approach for interventions that says here's what we can do about it, the intervention assessment phase. And then those actions are put into what we call a climate and health adaptation plan, which isn't just a list of interventions. It's a list of interventions and public health functions that are required to support those activities: enhanced surveillance, workforce development, communication, training, policy development that might are needed in support of these interventions. And then certainly, because this process is based on the principles of adaptive management, evaluation and incorporating and improving quality of activities is extremely important. So as I mentioned, the BRACE Step 2, projecting the disease burden process, is intended to provide estimates, not an exact measure, of the future burden of disease relevant to the principal exposures that a health department has considered. These are important because it can rank health outcomes, which are most important in the future, which might be less important. It can prioritize preventive actions and be important in designing these health adaptation plans. These variety or suite of options that are available for projecting the disease burden is described in this technical document that we've released called Projecting Climate-Related Disease Burden, a Guide for Health Departments. This is intended to provide a kind of instructive, illustrative approach of options for assessing these future health impacts. And typically, these approaches follow a sequence of activities from identifying the causal pathway, linking these exposures to health outcomes. This is critical because it identifies the linkage between the exposure, the vulnerability of individuals or locations, and the health outcomes, and is important in parameterizing the approach that will be taken. They use global climate models, very similar to the work that was presented before, to identify how these exposures might change in the future. And it's important to establish what the baseline burden of disease in a population is. Once that's done, and the exposure outcome association is assessed, these linkages between the change in the exposure and the baseline health outcome is used to assess what the burden is in the future. But certainly, as we see in all these studies, it's important to incorporate an uncertainty estimate into what these assessments are, because there is a tremendous amount of uncertainty in where things are going, how population will change, how climate policy might affect these exposures, and a number of other attributes that are certainly unknown. Assembling the data elements in creating this disease burden estimate is critical, and there are a number of options at each of these critical junctures. For climate data, it's certainly important to include historical information in that. And our Environmental Public Health Tracking Network, if you haven't are not aware of it, we try to bring together some climate and meteorologic information into this in a way that epidemiologists can use. We have taken the NLDOS, which is a modeled interpolated meteorologic data set, and conformed them to county boundaries so that a state or a county epidemiologist will not have to deal with gridded data. They can deal with county estimates of historic temperature, and in January we'll be releasing precipitation data on it. but also climate projections data from either the NARCAP, which was discussed earlier, or the Climate Modeling Intercomparison Project, which is the climate CMIP 3, which is the model we use in our tracking portal, or climate module of the tracking portal. Certainly for baseline disease prevalence, there are a number of data sources, either location-specific surveillance data or through case studies that provide estimates, either for a state or a county, et cetera. And the exposure outcome response function, which is important for modeling how things might change in the future, can come from a number of sources, either location-specific epidemiologic studies for the region in which you're working in, or analog studies, because in most cases you're not going to have that type of estimates provided in your region, and it's important to find the most appropriate analog for your investigation. And these can come from either modeling studies or time series or case crossover approaches. And certainly for demographic estimates, because these are people that you're talking about, and these populations change over time, there are a number of data sources for the demographic information, either census estimates and projections that can come from either state or from the federal level. So and this is one of the methods that we describe in this document, the Delta method, which basically, in the simplistic form, takes an estimate of the baseline health burden at the current time, and looks at the value of change in that estimate based upon the exposure changes from the climate model and the population projections, and provides an estimate of the attributable health impact of that climate change at some point in time. And this is again further described in our document, but it uses these exposure response estimates derived from the existing literature and applies it to the climate model in your particular region. And to reiterate, this process should be iterative because the knowledge is expanding. New types of data sources are very quickly becoming available, and each one of these processes, from developing the causal pathway, assembling the data elements, projecting the disease burden, and performing the uncertainty analysis, should certainly be revisited from time to time, as uncertainty hopefully will be reduced over time. If you're interested in more information about what our grantees are doing and how they're doing this, we've partnered with APHA to describe in detail the activities that they're taking in this document called Adaptation in Action. We released it earlier in the year, and it provides a nice illustration of some of the success stories that we call from the field from our BRACE grantees. So thank you for your time, and apologies for delivering this out of order.
No worries.
We do have time for questions. I will call out, though, for students of public health and professors of public health, what we just saw here were the three core functions of public health being described in their various configurations, assessment, assurance, and policy development, were all described by each of the speakers, and it's nice to see some of that threaded together. With that, do we have any questions? Ma'am?
That's a really important question, and it's one that comes up, of course, a lot in this arena. You know, a really important piece is affordable housing, making sure that you're keeping affordable housing in the neighborhood. So with the California Hotel Project, the developer, as well as the collaborative that the developer formed with other agencies and organizations working in the area, they're looking at purchasing buildings and ensuring that some of it's affordable housing, some of it's low-income housing, and some of it's market rate, so that they retain a mix and so that people can continue living in their neighborhood. So that's one of the strategies, is to sort of progressively attempt to keep buying enough land or enough buildings and so forth to keep affordable housing. But the other piece that I think is just as important is the strategies to make sure that the people that are living in the neighborhood are getting what they need to change, for their own circumstances to change. So rather than just thinking about how gentrification is going to drive people out, thinking about how the people living there can get to a point where those increased values are not going to drive them out. So they're starting, and so that some of that is looking like supporting entrepreneurs and small business owners, local business owners, to strengthen their businesses. Some of it is support, job training support, and job placement support, and resume support, and you know, everything that would help folks get employed. And some of the big pieces is also youth development, making sure that kids have the education they need and the steps all along the way to get them into both a good, strong educational track and also youth development support. So I think those are the things that I'm seeing. I think that I would be really interested in some more systematic look at how that's working out, because that's, my case studies didn't tell me that.
Thank you.
Thanks. Other questions? Sir?
For Dr. Hooper, my background was, I was part of the regional catastrophic planning for the Chicago area. And none of that stuff was being discussed 3 years ago. I wonder how much of that is included DHS and FEMA planning now. If any.
Well, that's a good question. And did I see Elena walking? Did she? So it's my understanding that Illinois was the first state to take the BEST grant and put in considerations of climate change into the way the state hands money down to the county. Is that right?
Yeah. So we work with the communal department in choosing, offering the population awareness grant that key deep issues in the state and then the local departments and resource officers. And so the language has been adjusted that they are required to take into consideration the increase of frequency and severity of extreme weather events when they're doing their hazard vulnerability assessments. And there's been a lot of questions in terms of guidance of how to do that and we're going to be working on that next step.
So that's a huge change in success that we're just beginning to get our heads around. That we're kind of a part of CDC, and we're trying to develop the way in which public health in general can view climate change as a stressor, and to have that lens by which they can look at all kinds of health effects, from Lyme disease to extreme weather, and you can do it empirically. And what we'd like to do is influence the way people think about planning for public health impact. And as we grow, we're a very new program. These types of successes where we say, listen, you have to consider this, and as we go up this money, you have to kind of think about how climate change would affect these exposures.
Okay. When you approach the state sector, do you go through the State Emergency Management Association with IEPH? Or?
Did we? Or this past time, we did not. But I definitely think it's a good idea. I know that we have a lot of the local health departments that we work with do work with, or closely work with the local emergency management agencies. So at the local level, there is that coordination.
Good. And there's not a whole lot of enthusiasm to do that around the country because as we look at climate models into the future, and either these multi-model ensembles, there's a lot of variability depending on some assumptions you make in the model about where things are going. So if you say, well, let's say by 2040, you could get a foot of sea level rise, 8 inches to 4 feet. And it depends on which model you use and how well it performs in that area. And so there's a lot of resistance in some of these areas to say, well, tell me the exact estimate, and then I'll do something about it. But that science is flawed. And so there's So there are challenges both on our side and on our team side.
Great, thank you.
Thanks, ma'am.
Just to follow up on that, I know that there's been a lot of interest, particularly at the state and local level, about mapping projections about where diseases are likely to head, using Lyme disease as an example. So are your grantees incorporating mapping into disease projection? And also, because of the resources involved in doing this projection, to what extent is there sort of like a regionalization or company scale of doing projection, or do they tend to be sort of done, at the state or local level and then replicated if more funding is available?
Well, both. In New England, for example, it doesn't make sense for New Hampshire to do their own modeling and for Vermont to do the same, because they're very close and share a lot of the same geography and biology. So we have encouraged that. And in the case of Lyme disease, the work is beginning to be shared with some ecological niche models where microsuperable habitats for transmission, not where we find cases. That's a whole lot of another box of uncertainty with behavior and where people go, et cetera, but where it might be suitable for transmission, those types of studies are starting to begin.
All right, sir?
Question for Dr. Lemming. So looking forward at the ozone projection, what you assumed in the exercise you did was that there was no net change in human broad emissions going forward, correct?
Right.
So that's not going to be reality because of certain federal government programs, state programs that are already in place that are driving emissions down, and we're going to meet a new target with new ozone standard. And I'm kind of curious, have you done the projections to figure out, like, if everything that was sort of in motion right now was done with the appropriate emissions reductions, what the impact would be?
That's a great question. We received the grant in 2011 before natural gas, overtook coal, for example, as the primary electricity source. And we're it's a moving target in order to, estimate those impacts. But that is sort of the next step of our program, is to anticipate what air pollution, how clean power, et cetera, affect the precursors that we know affect health. Not yet.
Questions on this side? No? Ma'am?
Well, the selection of states, we didn't select states. States applied, and we went through a review process independent of our group, and the best applications were awarded. There wasn't the left coast, right coast, or one. And actually, if you look at the distribution of states, they're quite heterogeneous in regards to politics or in engaging with this issue. And what we'd like to do is to increase the number of states by getting more resources to do so. We're constrained by the amount of money we can give out. We already give out too little money for this. We're all the great people who agree with that. But I think this should be a 50-state program, and we have a lot to learn from that.
Thanks, please.
So sort of a follow-on question for you, Dr. Luper, about that. So are there the resources available for the fundraising cities initiatives to expand into more locations? That's one. And two, kind of a related question, have any of the current grantees found problems with getting their reports out in their states or cities because of the local political scene with, the difference between science and prevailing politics? And what would you do if that were the case?
The first question, as an executive branch agency, we support the president's budget. the president's budget would allow us to...
I'm going to tweet that, by the way.
But that's true, and the president's budget would support the expansion of grantees quite significantly at the third one, if the president's budget were real. The second is, it's hard to... I can't answer that question about... difficulty getting it out. Maybe you should have the grantees. Sorry.
Okay, in the back.
You mentioned some of the private and, some of the public and the philanthropic partners and doing some of this work in the community development field. Are there any promising partners in the private sector that you've seen, like solar panel companies or any of the green energy companies really jumping up to support some of these initiatives and being partners in the private sector?
Not those kinds of partners in the case studies that I saw, that I looked at. The corporate partners were much more sort of mainstream corporate, like unconnected to green building or health for that matter. So I didn't see anything like that in the case that's selected.
Okay, ma'am, next to the door.
I'm from the Hobby of Epidemiologists. I also support our health impact assessment program. So just a comment for Dr. Miller and then a question for Stuart. Have you published your findings that you're seeing that climate change isn't articulated as a component of some of these case studies you looked at?
The case studies are being published, but they're really, as I said at the outset, they're really focusing on the health component, like integrating health with community development. I don't, in the case studies themselves, I don't talk about climate.
We found, and I'll just sort of plug out that colleague, I don't know if you can hear, that we're organizing a HIA conference in Minneapolis in a couple weeks, and I'm presenting on the intersection between health impact assessment, hoping that those of you here are familiar with that, and climate change and how health impact assessments, which are done on so many transportation planning kind of initiatives, are completely missing the boat in terms of making the connection between health impact and climate change. And I really found your findings, they really resonated with me, and I don't know why that, you know, people that are involved in doing health impact assessments are, I don't know, fearful or hesitant about making those connections between aspects of a project or plan being assessed and climate change. I think it's such a missed opportunity, and I'm really hoping that people that are involved, HIA practitioners, will jump on board using HIA as a mechanism to make those real life, you know, project decision specific aspects, you know, make those connections back to climate change. They can make it really obvious to people that are affected by projects that are very localized. So, might want to talk to you more about that.
So sorry to follow up with you here.
Question for George about getting back to your comment about how to downscale the projection data for local jurisdictions at state or, you know, at the state level. In Minnesota, we have an excellent professor researcher at U of M, and he wanted to produce downscale data on, you name it, precipitation, temperature, wind speed for use in our state. And, you know, there's really no, and I'll just skip to my question, where are the federal funding mechanisms to help, you know, local researchers do that work to get those, you know, state-specific downscale projections? Because Minnesota, we're really lucky. I think that we have a pretty sympathetic government, local government, state government with climate change. But even still, we identified a legislative funding mechanism to help this researcher get $500,000, the university would match it, $1 million or so to do this project. We assembled folks from Department of Natural Resources, Department of Ag, certainly Department of Health.
Ma'am, I'm going to ask you to get to your question, please.
Okay, I'm getting there. And it was still a hard road. We still had a very large fight to get this work funded. I think it will get funded. So the question is, how do we get more money so that people in state can get the projected data for their state?
I think the key way to leverage that is to show the societal benefits of this type of work. So there's a lot of money going into climate modeling, climate research. The work model that you discussed is probably the best way to do downscale climate models for communities. Computation is extremely expensive, but we have to show to the meteorologic or climatologic community that there are societal benefits for this type of work, and that not only promotes their mission, NASA and NOAA are keen to see the health community being involved, because we've got satellites. Can we use them for something useful? They're very expensive, and it helps us up because we're using this in a coarse way. We'd like to do it better. Their mission is enhanced, and they're constantly asking us to show the benefits of the benefits of their mission. And this is slow to accrue, granted. We haven't been at this for very long, but those types of arguments are being made increasingly so. And so computational time on supercomputers is a little bit more available to do work modeling, and they're seeing health as a great partner in their effort to move their science forward. So what I would say is keep at it and show the benefits to the community on this work, that if you translate this type of approach into health benefits, not just theoretical but actual, and
So let's take maybe one or two more questions. Dr. Miller passed me a little cheat sheet, and she said, Dave, do you want to announce the passage of the new APHA climate change policy statement? I would be delighted to do that. And that the climate change will be the theme of the 2017 APHA conference. By the way, my hometown of Denver will be the host of next year's APHA, and we hope to see you there. But how about one more question before we wrap up? Sir, if you can keep it brief, please.
For you, I'm a healthy homes practitioner. Is there any plan to dovetail some of these concerns into the work that people might be doing on a day-to-day basis in healthy homes?
So thank you for that question. In San Antonio in 2016, in June, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development will be co-locating with NEHA for their annual conference. All of their cooperative agreement recipients are required to attend the conference. We are going to be focused like a laser on those issues. We have a very exciting program. I'll have to pay you for teeing this up for me. I appreciate that. But this is something... All right, very good. But this is something that's important to us. We're slowly coming out of a state of torpor in many ways, and we're edging off. We're hopefully addressing more contemporary issues that are germane to public health writ large. Sorry. Okay. Well, I'd like to thank everyone for being here, for our presenters, Dr. LeMay, Dr. Luger, and Dr. Miller. One more round of applause, please.